The recording has started.
You're on. Good evening and welcome to Race Talk, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All of our shows are recorded and can be found on the website www.racinghistoryproject.com. This is your host, Trish England, and we have a fun conversation ahead of us. Young racing crew guys are like big wave surfers. They travel afar to find the biggest waves to match their talents and skill sets. They follow the opportunities, and they reap the victories and the defeats with their eyes on the races to come. Tonight, we have three well-known crew chiefs who started out young in the racing business and have known each other for over 30 years of friendship and experience, crisscrossing each other's careers during IMSA's most formative era, Michael Colucci, Gary Cummings, and John Shapiro. I'm getting noise. Michael Colucci came out of upstate New York with a love of sports car racing at nearby Watkins Glen. Somebody needs to mute their phone, please. A tour of Vietnam as a tank mechanic, gauging some wrenching skills, but moreover a talent for diagnostics and troubleshooting. He fell into an IMSA team by a miracle performed by Bob Snodgrass that landed him at Brumos in 1973, just in time for Sebring, his first professional race. From there, the only way he could go was up, working for some of the top teams in IMSA, racking up wins and experience as he reached crew chief status. Michael retired from the series in 2010. Today, he's a consultant and strategist for smaller teams with his company MCR and races his own factory-built 911 Porsche Cup car around Florida whenever he can. Gary Cummings is a South Florida boy who raced F Production Sprites and 916s in SECA and then Powerboat in the later 1970s until he was introduced to Preston Henn and began working for him on his cars in the swap shop's early days in IMSA. He campaigned with several extremely successful pro teams over the following years until he headed across the Atlantic in 1985 to work for World Endurance Racers. For the next 22 years, racking up some championships, he has the distinction of being the first and only American crew chief to win the WEC championship for a European team for Walter Bruin in 1986. Coming home, he worked in series management positions for Rolex Grand Am and for IMSA during the merger, and he's been general manager for Road Atlanta. He now retired and lives in Gainesville, Georgia. John Shapiro is another Floridian who was bitten by the racing bug very early. The youngest of our three guests, he started drag racing a Dodge Charger at age 16 and went to work for a small prep shop where he was recruited by Preston Henn, a client of the shop. Their first race together was at Riverside in 1980. That's where he met Gary. With a few exceptions, John worked for Porsche teams most of his time as a crewman. At age 21, he was the youngest winning crew chief in IMSA at Laguna Seca for JLP in 1982. With the opening of his shop, ProTech, in 1990, he became a subcontractor for several pro teams, including Jim Busby's Miller 962. Even off the racing circuit, he managed to run into Mike and Gary on occasion, often resulting in further racing adventures. Today, he is retired and living on a farm in Tennessee. There are a million stories on the naked racetrack. Let's sit back and hear a few. Thanks to our guests and our audience for joining us. Mute your phones and enjoy. We'll start with Michael, I guess. We did this sort of in the alphabetical order.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me that wound out what I just said?
Well, you hit it pretty much on the head. I got my love of racing at Watkins Glen, and through my association of knowing Bob, because he grew up in Elmira, New York, he got me an interview with Peter Gregg. Peter gave me a start in racing, and I've been lucky to be associated with those guys in the beginning. They kind of were my mentors, and it doesn't hurt working for a successful team. So it was kind of a stepping stone for me.
What team was your favorite of all the ones you worked for?
My own.
Oh, yes. Well, what a dumb question.
So I never got in arguments with the boss. I argued a lot with my wife, but I never argued with me.
Well, but you did work for some really good ones.
Yeah, I worked for some really interesting characters. Preston Henn, Peter Gregg, Danny Ongais, and Ted Field. Jim Busby, I worked with him for 5 years on his project. I worked with Kevin Jeanette. I worked with Dave Mirage at Champion Porsche. I did his deal. I worked with Jim Matthews and David Murray with his program. I've been a racing junkie my whole life.
Well, it's worked for you, and you're still doing it, sort of.
Well, yeah. Well, I love it. Yeah, I mean, what else would you do? I mean, it's the easiest job to have. It's not really a job.
I don't.
But how can you argue with that? Not really. You're doing stuff you love. I never had to go work a day in my life.
I will move on over to Gary. We're going to do these little parts quickly because I've got some questions for you. Somebody is rattling the heck out of their phone, and I don't know who it is.
It's not us.
It's not me.
Not me. It's not me. Okay. All right.
Is it still rattly?
Yeah, we'll see. Folks, sorry about this. We've had some technical difficulties as we were getting ready to come on, and it's better than it was, but not perfect. Gary Cummings is a South Florida boy who raced F Production Sprites. I said that. Gary, what can you add to this?
You know, I think I was one of the things that I decided a long time ago that I wanted to chase my dreams and not have a kids and wife and mortgage and all of that until much later. And I always blame standing in 4 inches of water in the B paddock at Lime Rock for moving me towards Europe. I said, if I'm going to stand in this much rain, I'd rather do it in the Nürburgring. And knowing John Fitzpatrick from the days that I was at Gerritsen in 81 and 82, I applied for a job. And my goal was, when I left for Europe, that I wanted to be the crew chief for the Jägermeister car with Stefan Bellof and Terry Boutsen. And unfortunately, Bellof got killed in 85 at Spa. But at the end of the 85 championship, with help from Jürgen Barth and Gert Schmidt at Porsche, I got an introduction to Brun and spent four of my favorite years with Brun Motorsports, first in Germany and then later in Switzerland, running up to 27 races a year in the World Championship.
Wow.
Some of them in IMSA, full season in Japan, Interseries, and Super Cup, which was the precursor to DTM in those days that was run with Group B cars. But
wow.
Had a great
27 in a year.
Yeah, 27 in a year. You travel with your passport in your pocket, and I think one of the things that we would do is. I think it was the Miami Grand Prix. We ran the Miami Grand Prix with Lorari and Sagala. And on Monday morning, we would fly to Tokyo, and we had a car that we kept in Japan and run the following weekend in Japan. Then we'd all fly, the crew chiefs would all fly to Spain, and we would run like at Jerez normally. And then we had a week off where we would do tire testing at Michelin and Clermont-Ferrand. And then we had an inter-series race, and then we would jump back on a plane and go back to the States and then go back to Japan. So it was, I think, three continents, five races in 6 weeks on three continents. But,
and how many also?
None. You know, in those days,
wow.
In 86, 87, the Porsche was a very good car, and we wound up beating the Porsche factory with their own piece. out-drivered their drivers, ran the limited slip when they didn't, and it was a blast. You know, we really were living the dream.
Wow. Why don't you come back?
Oh, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, from Brunn, I wound up going to Japan, and when he went Formula One racing with a Jura Brunn deal, and then we did a bunch of projects. We did Paris-Dakar and some other things, and, you know, eventually it's time to come home.
Well, you still have family here, I guess.
Yeah, my dad was still in South Florida and still is. So it was after being on the road that long, it was time to come home and spend some time with family.
Okay, let's see John for a second here. Hi. Johnny, how are you tonight?
Okay.
Good.
Well, you know, Michael said that when you start off with a good team, it's really easy to get going in the fast lane. And I was with Pressman for a short time when I was able to get a job with John Paul in JLP Racing. And at that time, they were the team to be on, so it was a gift, really, to be hired by them, and I enjoyed every minute of that, and I was living the dream as well. And when Johnny went from the sports cars to Indy cars, I was the only guy from the sports car team that went to the Indy car team and joined that, and that was fantastic because that was another dream come true. Oh yeah, we won the Michigan 500, but that's just, you know, part of the luck of the being in the right place at the right time. But and then it was almost as if, you know, being in the right place at the right time is something that I could say had a lot to do with my career. I ended up being on some really great teams and working with some really fantastic people. And so for 40 years, it was living the dream, no doubt. And but I kind of took a different turn in the mid I guess it was late 80s where I opened my own shop, and because there was an opportunity there that just presented itself, and I saw it as a chance to have my own, you know, be the master of my own domain. And we got lucky there, too. We had some great customers, and one thing led to another. That lasted a long, long time. And then I went from there to two other teams, and then there's a lot of bouncing around in this business, as you know, Gary and Michael have described that you started off that you follow, you're chasing the wave, and wherever the work is, whenever the good opportunities when they come about, it's just something you have to decide to do, and you make the sacrifice. And it's almost always a sacrifice in some way when you choose to go motorsports for a living. But as Michael said, I've never worked a day in my life.
Well, I got a question for all three of y'all that you can consider alternately. As being a crew chief, do you develop a method that you travel with from shop to shop, or do you compromise with the way things were done before you got there, or how do you work that out? How do you manage a team?
Well, who do you want to start with, Chris?
we all have different
methods. My experience has been to work with the existing framework with the people and try to modify it the best you can without alienating the people that are there, because they have their own methods. And usually it's just a case of one or two missing parts or missing people from keeping them from being successful. And without being totally radical, I mean, if you come in there with a whole different format and tried to change the whole team, you get a lot of backlash and alienate people, and he won't get very much very much cooperation.
I know you're right.
So that's always been my philosophy. It varies from place to place. It depends on who's there and how many people. Sometimes there's nobody there, and you get to hire everybody. And sometimes you're the odd guy out, and there's 6 or 7 or 8 people or 10 people there that have already been together and had their own bonding, and you have to work around that. It's not always expeditious to fire everybody and hire a new crew.
And that was Michael. Okay. Gary, what you think?
I think that when you're at a certain level and going into pro teams, and my example would be when I left Preston and went to work for Gerritsen, and had Greg Eliff and Jerry Woods and some terrific support guys and Martin Raffoff. But, when you go into another good team, there are guys that can always show you something. And when we introduced the first Lola in 81 for Brian Redmond, it's a ground effects car. We had John Bright come over. You can't have the arrogance of, I know everything about everything, because you wind up not. And that'll cause you have to be open-minded to learn something. When I went to Europe and went from working in England, which you had some very smart guys, Richard Lloyd's team were the first Porsche Group C team. They developed the limited slip for the transmission. None of the Germans had that. And when I went to Brunn, I carried a limited slip with me that they bought, and I carried it down, and we were the only German team that had the limited slip. But what I learned was a lot of other stuff that the German guys were doing that we didn't know. So you have to be open-minded. Like Michael said, you go into a new beginning team and you're bringing in everybody from the get-go. One, that's very hard to do, because good guys are always working. And especially if you're looking at the older guys, you want me to move from Florida to California? Well, in those days we did. And we lived 4 and 5 guys in a house, and nobody had a car, or one guy had a car, and 3 of us always rode in with it. But you were on the road all the time, and it didn't matter. But you had to go in with some patience, and occasionally if a team did have problems, it came down to 1 or 2 guys, and you determined that fairly soon when you were there. And you might have to eliminate those guys, and it normally made everybody else stand up a little bit straighter, and work a little bit harder. And most younger guys were open to learning, and that was the biggest thing. I'd rather have a willingness to learn than an overall ability on a team.
Gotcha. That's a good answer. John?
Yeah, so as I said, in the late 80s, I started my own prep shop and then had my own teams. So the, call it the management side of it was, it was sort of, it came as, it came to me as basically monkey see, monkey do for what I had learned to that point from guys like Michael and Gary. And applied what I knew and what I'd seen, and tried to not do what I didn't like being an employee, and tried to be the best that I could be at doing that job. And admittedly, maybe that wasn't my strongest suit as being a manager, team manager. I've always been better at the technical, the dynamic side of the cars and making them go fast and things like that. And that's what I enjoy more so. And then when I closed my shop, for example, because I got tired of being a manager and the grief and the stress of running a race team, because it's really very difficult business to be in. Like if you were to show an investor a business plan for a race team, they'd laugh at you. It's because they wouldn't. It's just a terrible idea. It's a losing proposition at best. So you have to work very hard to make it a success. And as in later years, I got on to be in the fly-in engineering type of role, which I loved. And that goes kind of back to what Michael's saying. When you show up as a fly-in engineer, for example, no one's really happy to see you, because if you're there, it means something's not going right. You know, something's wrong, and here's this guy.
They called in the FBI. You
know? Oh, I love it, Ben. Tony's exactly right.
You really, so most now know what, and every now and then there's some guy that is happy to see you because he's tired of it going the way it's been going. And luckily, that's happened many times, but other times not so much. And it's you have to walk with, you know, with kid gloves and be nice and try to be as call it, you know, yeah, you got to earn your way in, but you have to, rather than coming and telling everybody what to do, you come with ideas and suggestions and maybe stories of things that worked for you before, and you present them and hopefully that you can prove something, and that the first session you do well, and then you suddenly, after the first day of practice, you've made some progress, more progress than they had recently. So then suddenly they start coming on board. But there's always that one guy that's mad at you for doing well. It's happened often. It's normally a grit. I didn't say that, Gary. Gary and Michael's laughing really hard, so that might tell you something.
Well, no, we've all had those experiences, John.
My last test was this year in February, and I had to call it quits. I decided it's been enough, and it's not because I wanted to, but I just had to. And I never thought I would ever quit.
We're going to break for a message from our sponsor. If I can find it. Wait. Race Talk is produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All of our shows are recorded and can be found on the website, www.racinghistoryproject.com. Okay, I have a question that's going to bring us to an adventure. Colucci told me a story about the 1984 Le Mans that just boggled my brain, and I want y'all to tell that story. He and Gary were together on this, and I don't know how they survived the night.
The night? Well,
the whole week.
Well, it started off when Gary and I went to Europe to collect Preston's 956 and get it ready for Le Mans, and it was in England in this little garage, just basically bigger than a double car garage, and it was like a cave inside there. We decided right away that we couldn't work there, so called Preston up and said, this isn't going to work here. And Preston said, well, let me make a few phone calls and get back to you. So he called me back the next day and said he talked to Jürgen Barth at Porsche, and they had a program where we could take the car over there and work in the factory workshop at Porsche, at Weissach, right next to the factory teams, the Porsche factory team, and prep the car. And if we needed help from any of the mechanics, that they were available to help us. And, of course, all the parts were right there and all the technical expertise. So we loaded up this 956 on an open trailer behind this box truck and dragged it across the English Channel through France and over to Germany, or from Belgium and over to Germany, and we looked like a bunch of gypsies for this thing. Rolled it into the shop and started to take the car apart. And the guys were really, really, really helpful over there. But they clearly were not used to seeing Americans work on cars like this. It was pretty exceptional. they were the Germans were used to being really compartmentalized, so they had specialist people that did all sorts of little jobs, and specialist people that did the wiring, specialist people that did the body work, and specialist people that built the uprights, and specialist people that did the transmission, and of course the engine went over to the engine shop, and anything in between went to specialists. So Gary and I just got the car in the shop and proceeded to dismantle the whole thing, including the transmission. And they were completely aghast at what we were doing. And it was...
How long did it take you?
How long did it take? We were there, I don't know, Gary, what do you think? It was like six or seven or eight weeks?
Five and a half weeks. We were.
How many?
I think it was 5.5 weeks.
Okay, seemed like a year.
Well, when did you? At what point was it ready to go to Le Mans?
Just before it was time to go to practice. the work used up all the available time, basically. But we had a special situation since we had to go a little bit early. The car needed to be painted because it had been repaired a little bit when it was England, and it was like three different colors. So we left to go to Le Mans with that same van and open trailer, dragged this 956. And we found body shop. The guys at Rondo, who we were working with, found this body shop that had been used by Steve McQueen when he did his Le Mans movie. And it was just a little bit further down the Mulsanne Strait. And so we took the car there, and those guys painted a nice shade of black, and we worked in Rondeau shop, and we just showed up and raced it. Luckily, we finished second. We had John Paul and John Rondeau as drivers. And,
just two drivers for the 24.
We were supposed to have three.
And Rondeau was sick.
Yeah, he was sick, and Johnny, we basically beat the hell out of Johnny. He was like Superman. He did double and triple stints in the car. I told you the story about the wheel coming off at Indianapolis, and he was just totally unfazed by the whole thing. You know, he just showed up on pit road with his car because we didn't really have good radio communication. And, you know, kind of bouncing up pit road on three wheels. One of the front wheels was missing. I stuck my head in the door. I said, Johnny, what happened? He said, the wheel came off at Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. I said, Jesus. So we jacked the car up and lifted it up on the air jacks and looked up under the front, and there was no damage to the nose, and didn't do any damage to the brake disc because it was bouncing along on that. Put a new wheel on, filled it up with gas, and sent him back out. We never got the wheel back, so we never figured out what happened to it. It had been on there for 15 or 16 laps. Somebody got our 956 wheels and swooped in. But that,
and
that
you
was
still
pretty
finished
second.
Time.
We still finished second overall. We lost to Yost. Yost beat us by a lap and a half. You know, we were kind of the new kids on the block with those guys down there. Go ahead, Gary.
So, what I was going to say, Michael, is something that I discovered later on when I was at Brunn that I think Yost knew that we didn't know. There was a special ring and pinion. And if you remember, Yost was really quick on Mulsanne. I mean, and we couldn't figure out. And we saw the same thing when we were at Fitzpatrick, that the top German cars were like 20K faster down Mulsanne. And, you know, back in those days, we were doing, 380 kilometers an hour down the thing. And I wonder if that wasn't part of the issues we have. I think one thing, Trish, that was extremely funny that when we were at the factory, and inside of ISOC is the little area called Flock, and you go inside ISOC and then you go down the hill, and that's where the Rothmans team was, and we had a Volkswagen Beetle that was yellow and had been made in Mexico. So we're driving around in this bright yellow Volkswagen Beetle, these two Americans, and so that they kind of had to hide us. And so we had to wear the maroon bib overalls that the factory guys have, and we weren't ever allowed to leave the room where we had the car. Well, after about the first week or so, we would start to sneak around. We saw the the automatic transmission, the PDK. We saw that being jigged up on a factory car a year before it was ever run. We had one day where we heard this noise coming, and we went to the door, and it was this little sexy tank with like a 50 caliber gun on the front of it that goes, like 14 feet long, that goes shooting by us at 40 miles an hour. And we looked over, and the head guy from the shop is called Timo. And we go, Timo, what was that? And he goes, oh, no, you didn't see this. There was a lot of fun stuff. We stayed in a little guest house over a butcher shop, and about every two or three days, about 6 o'clock in the morning, you'd hear this squealing, and here's three big old German guys dragging this 300-pound pig in by the ears, and it's fighting tooth and nail there to not get out, or to get out. It was a real good time, great time actually, and we did have a new 962 104 that we ran in the event as well. We wound up having the distributor issue with that, I think.
Yeah, broke the distributor cap after 18 hours.
Yeah.
Who was driving that one?
Preston was driving that with Elaine Ferte and I think Elaine's brother. So it was the two Fertes and Preston.
Michelle Ferte, I think, and somebody else. I don't remember if it was Elon or not.
Yeah.
Somebody can look that up.
Yeah. There's one funny story about being there in the Porsche factory. You know, when Porsche made the 962, the bolts that held the lower control arms were, one of the bolts was a measuring point for the front ride height. And so they put the bolt in from the bottom up and put the nut inside. And so all of the American teams thought this was crazy. So we took the bolts out and put them in from the top down, because if the nut ever came out, at least the bolt wouldn't fall out. So when we got the car to the Porsche factory, you know, all of the German mechanics that were working in there, one by one, they'd come over and kind of look at our car. And every day it'd be a new one, and they would say, hey, you guys know you got the bolt in upside down. And we'd say, yeah, we know that. Another guy would come by and say, you know that bolt upside down? We know that. Finally, after a week, we came in, and somebody had taken the bolt out and put it back in the other way the factory had installed it. They couldn't stand it anymore.
Ouch!
That's absolutely.
You knew that I would do that.
They just couldn't take it. That it was, we were so unorthodox to them. They couldn't handle it. Oh, we had a great time. That was one of the highlights of my career, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about a race and where you all worked together.
We all went to Japan and helped Gary there, Johnny and I did. Johnny and I worked together more times, I think, than Gary and I.
Yeah,
Johnny came and helped us at Busby's and when I was there.
We did Sebring all together, 94, I think, with Toy Store.
Yes, we did. Was it 94? It was the first year of the World Sports Car, whatever year that was.
Yeah. So we finished second to you. The first year you were there, the second year we finished second, and you would always go on to somebody else.
Yeah, so I was with Champion. As a matter of fact. That was the year we had James Weaver, Andy Wallace, and who else was there? Derek Bell.
Mm-hmm.
With the World Sports Car. That was the.
And I think we had Derek. I had Derek and Tiff in Japan when you guys came over. And Reed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Reed. Slender
and
Reed.
Mm-hmm. That one of the funny things about that is we've all been crew chiefs and mechanics and whatnot. And at that point, when we went to work for Gary, Michael had already been a very successful crew chief and engineer, and And I had my own shop, and I was already doing the crew chiefing and engineering. And we went to work for Garius Mechanics. And, yeah, we were maybe qualified for the job, but just because you've been wherever you've been, you know, and sometimes when you go racing, you go to do whatever you can do to help in whatever capacity. And there's never a, at least if any professional that I've ever worked with, has never looked down their nose at a lower task or job, because we've all been there before. And that was one of the most fun times we ever had, is when I went to work for Gary's Mechanic. We had a ball.
It was relaxing, wasn't it?
Well, it is. And it's uniquely satisfying to be able to do that stuff with your hands. I mean, and Johnny will tell you the same thing, is that I always liked fabricating little bits and doing whatever you could do that wasn't time critical because of what our other responsibilities were. But, yeah, it was fun to be a mechanic again. Absolutely.
Yeah, and who wants to have to hassle with not enough hotel rooms at Sebring? You know, show me something. Greg Eliff used to say it when we were at Garrison, the tweak of the week. And there was a lot of that, Michael, when we ran Preston's car out of
Bobby G.
And Michael and Jack were there. There was always, what can you do every week to make the car? If you're ahead of the game, how do you make something special? Jerry Woods introduced, as far as I know, he was the first one that came up with the fire extinguisher that you could add water to the car. Without taking the radiator cap off.
Oh, no, Jack Atkinson had already had that in 73 when I got there with Grandma.
Yeah, well, we didn't see it in
California. Oh, well. Nothing new under the sun.
No, there isn't.
Okay, speaking of John Paul Jr., if you look at the current flock of kids and drivers out there right now, which one of those most reminds you of Johnny and his racing style?
Ooh, I don't know, man. Johnny was a unique individual, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, you're right about that.
And he was a great kid. I loved working with Johnny. I don't really have anybody that I could really compare to him. I really don't.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
Every driver has their own little nuances and their own style, and some are more personable and some are irascible or hard to get along with. Like Wallach was probably one of the most difficult people I ever worked with, and Hans Stuck was probably the most personable person I ever worked with. But, you know, Johnny was Johnny.
You know, if I had to come up with somebody in the current, because knowing how quiet, you know, the kid could be. And that's one thing I think that is very cool here, that all three of us had worked with Junior. And one of the things that none of us have said yet, you know, the as a crew chief, you learn from the guys, you learn from the drivers, you know, you get somebody really good in the car and you learn the car better. It makes you a better engineer. It makes you be able to adjust the car. If I had to say the current folks, and, you know, I've been looking at it from a race control thing for, you know, a lot of years. Ricky Taylor reminds me a lot of the kid. You know, he's quiet. There's not a lot of drama with him. He gets the job done. He's killer on track. And he walks away, and you never know he was there. And Junior was a lot like that as well.
Yeah, I, you know,
uh-huh.
Racing today is also very different than it was then. You know, you had two guys for 24 hours in many cases, but the racing was different, and it was, we didn't have ABS and we didn't have traction control, and and these cars had crazy amounts of power and the turbocharged, so that the way they're much more difficult to drive than the cars are today. And the suspension was archaic. These things were lethal beasts that these guys were wheeling around at insane speeds. And the kid had a certain fearlessness first. I'd seen him do things that people would just never even try. And he would never give up. Like the guy said, Michael said, the wheel came off in Indianapolis. That's nothing. The thing would be on fire or whatever, and he wouldn't be fazed. Tell me when the fire gets close to the cockpit. You know?
I'm
insanely fortunate to have been there. We won the championship, and then we, went to IndyCars, and he wasn't expected to do great things when he went to IndyCars because he didn't come up through the Formula Car ranks as most of those guys do. And we came in, and he showed up, and he was fast right away, and he won his third race in his career at the Michigan 500, and it wasn't a gift. He earned that race. He raced it and beat everybody, so it was quite good. And it was fast and in pole positions and things like that. And he would just where the first Trans Am race he was ever in, he won the first race he was ever in, the first Formula Ford race he was in. He has some kind of crazy history like that, that wherever he showed up, the first time he ever raced in any certain car, he won his first race. I know in the 935 was the first race he ever won in that he ever drove in the 935, he won that race. And I think maybe the IndyCars was the first time he didn't win his first race. So that doesn't happen anymore. So it's hard to compare anybody to him, really. Sure, there's plenty of fantastic drivers now, but they have data to work with, and the data is just incredibly valuable today to be able to science out what you're doing wrong and where the light gains and losses are, and the simulation programs and all the help that you have that those guys back then didn't have. They had to figure it out, that's the biggest difference I see. They didn't have the driver aids, including the data, to work with. They had to figure it out and just do it. And that's what separates the guys from then than they are now. And so it's hard to compare really directly, but really, I don't know if I've worked with a lot of great people. All three of us have, and I'm not sure I've ever worked with anybody like that since.
I would agree with John.
That makes me feel good.
Johnny was something special.
Yes, he was. And I always thought of him as a kid, more like a nephew, but he grew up fast.
He sure did.
I'm going to open it up to the audience. Does anybody have any questions for these three?
Keep it civil.
Hey, Bobby G here.
Bobby G. Yeah. Bobby G. Oh, man. Great to hear your voice.
I love you three.
We love you too, Bobby.
You're crying. You guys are the best. My career would not be what it is without you guys.
I would remember
Bobby. God, I love you guys.
Bobby was, I worked with Bobby at Busby's for a few years. Bobby was great. Bobby was one of the exceptional students of racing, I would say.
And who's been more successful? I mean, look what you've turned it into, Bobby, with all your frauds and talent.
I know. Just driven to try to be like you guys.
Well, I can tell you from my experiences.
One of the funny stories, I think we crashed the Brun car in qualifying at Daytona, and Buzz was running the Nissan. Were you there, Michael?
Probably.
Somewhere.
Bobby,
yeah, I was there a lot.
We popped the engine, I think, in the warm-up or something, and they said, you know, we've got to change this engine before the race. And I'd never worked on a Nissan. I just got brought over to help. And I remember
that was 1990.
Bobby and I were underneath this, underneath the car, and it's warm, and we're trying to unbolt everything, and we got this giant oil feed line that thing's about as big around as your forearm, and we're both looking at it, and we know this thing is going to shoot a stream of hot oil about 2 inches in diameter out, and we try to get the pan out there, and you got it going, you're pulling this thing out, and pull the line off it, and oil shoots about 4 feet, and I remember I can see your face. Looking at both of our eyes popped open, and we just started laughing out loud. But we got the engine. We actually got the engine changed in record time and got that car in. But that's the first – one of the first times that I can really remember seeing the laughter in your face at that time.
Oh, yeah. I remember that exactly. That was 1990. The engine blew up in the warm-up, and shit, we had to start it up before the car rolled onto the grid. So – we were warming the engine up while they were playing the national anthem. Man, we caught hell.
Yep. Yep.
poor Jim Busby. He was flabbergasted. He couldn't believe that this was happening. But, yeah, we got it all done. Later on, the engine expired in the race, and we were running the top three or four.
Sorry about that.
Huh?
Yeah. Mine is Gary, though. Johnny was there to help us build that car that won the 24-hour. You know, this was like late nights, him and Roy.
Oh, 89, yeah.
89, yeah.
Yeah, 89 with the Miller High Life car. Yeah, Johnny was there.
Johnny and Roy came out to help us build that car. Roy trussed up an alligator in Clucci's house.
Oh, don't even go there, Bobby.
Step back to that one for a second here.
But was Bob?
Yeah. Racing was a lot looser in those days.
You know, but Johnny Shapiro went back and talked about some real stuff. It was just raw. Everybody had to figure everything out. You know, we were all just there to help everybody learn, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Because we just had to.
I think one of the things was that you don't have in so many teams, and I've worked with guys that have been in F1, I've been in World Championship, I've been IMSA, but so many guys now, they're compartmentalized. You know, I'm only a shot guy, or I'm only this. One of the things that I always loved about sports car guys is, if you didn't know how to weld, you wanted to learn how to weld. You know, if you didn't know how to do the alignment of the car, you learned how to do the alignment of the car. You know something about everything and everything about something. You know, you knew how to drive the truck. And if you didn't know how to drive the truck, the truck driver stopped and you got in without a CDL and started driving to Texas where it's flat, you know.
Gary, Mike, I shamed Mike recently. I go, Mike. You know, when I took a job, you offered me $1,200 a month to work there. And it's, Mike, I want to go to Daytona. Nope, we don't have room to take you. I go, well, the truck's going. Can I ride in the truck? And he goes, yeah, if you want to ride in the truck. And that's exactly what it was. And I told the truck driver, well, I'm just not going to sit over here. Show me how to drive this thing.
Yeah, and then Bobby became the truck driver.
When I went to England in 85, we were on $400 a week, and we had to pay for our own house. And Carl Jennings, who wound up being at Rosberg, and Jim Steger, who was the head guy from Audi Parts for years and years, and myself lived in a house, and it had a machine that if you wanted electricity, you put a 50p coin in for electricity, and we would only put in enough electricity to be able to watch TV, and we'd sit in the dark with woolly hats and jackets on, you know, and that's just what you did. I mean, I can't, in Garrison in 81, I slept on a couch in a house with three other guys. I didn't even know who they were.
you know, when you're at home.
You probably still don't.
You're on the road because you got per diem, whatever, $25 or whatever it was back then. You make a little bit of extra money, but you just did what it is. You didn't talk about a 401k, and I need to have mine, you know, the HR department call you about this and that. It wasn't. You just did it. You wanted to do it, you did it.
You wanted to do it, so you did it.
Yeah, when I went to work for Brumos in 1973, so Doc Bundy and I were making $125 a week.
I've heard that story.
We were lucky we got paid. I mean, it wasn't that we were cheap, but just that's what it was. I mean, we were basically indentured servants. I wanted to be in racing, and Doc wanted to be a driver.
Right.
So we endured a lot. Anyway, it was a fun learning experience. And Bobby G, I have to say this, Bobby G was one of those guys who just wanted to learn and get it done, whatever it took. And Bobby was a great guy to work with. We do. Great to see you at the race, Bobby.
Probably only.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah, really. Bobby, we need to borrow $20, man.
Well, I'm a race team owner. I don't got it.
Well, I mean, we were testing at Sebring this year. We had to go borrow a starter from Bobby.
Yeah.
The only guy that's got any money right now is Michael Shank, and I'm sure he's paying bills as fast as he can.
Yeah, good for him. He did a great job.
That was wonderful.
I loved watching Helio win that race. I'm not normally an IndyCar fan. That was special.
Jumping up and down. We're going to have to slowly wrap it up. We can have a few more minutes after we quit the recording, but I have corporate obligations here.
Well, we have non-corporate stories to tell.
I understand.
I've always maintained that the people in racing are a special kind of misfits. It's like running away to join the circus.
Heck, you are the circus.
We are a traveling circus. We're in the entertainment business. That's
what
we do.
That's exactly it.
We travel from town to town, put on a show, pack up, and go to the next town. We travel with the same people. We get to be friends with all of those people because we share the same common interests. And it's a special bond. You maybe feel something like that in the military. But it's a special deal, I'll tell you what. Not for everybody either.
In two weeks, on June 20th, we'll present a special IMSA GTU roundtable with winners. Amos Johnson.
Oh.
Joe Vardy.
Rick Knoop.
Lance Stewart. Jeff Klein. And Jack Baldwin. This one will be crazy. And you won't want to miss this one.
June 20th.
And it's all brought to you by Dave Wallen.
And the Racing History Project.
And it's www.racinghistoryproject.com. And you can listen to all our shows, including this one. It'll be up tomorrow. Okay, guys, go at it.
You still there, Bobby?